Much has been written about the World War II Nazi occupation of Paris, but often overlooked is the experience of Armenians during the occupation that fled to France during the Armenian Genocide of 1915. These genocide survivors watched as Jews, communists, and other so-called undesirables were removed from their communities in an eerily horrifying and similar way. Part political history, part coming-of-age story, the novel All the Light There Was tells the story of the Armenian community and resistance movement in 1940s Paris through the eyes of a teenage Armenian girl, Marl. The author, Nancy Krikorian, joins us from our studios at WGBH in Boston. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
So what inspired you to write about the Armenian experience in occupied 1940s Paris?
I grew up in the Armenian community of Watertown, Massachusetts, attending the Armenian Evangelical Church and local public schools, and grew up in a house with my Armenian grandmother. My first novel, Zabel, was a fictionalized account of her experience as an Armenian genocide survivor and immigrant bride. Then my second novel, Dreams of Bread and Fire, was a coming-of-age story also set in that same community. And one of the characters in the book was a Marxist-Leninist revolutionary who set off a bomb. And in doing the research for that character, I was reading about non-state actors who use political violence. So I was reading everything from stuff about, you know, the Weather Underground to the Symbionese Liberation Army to the Red Army Brigade. And while doing that, I started thinking about the French Resistance, because these were also non-state actors using political violence. And I came across a 1984 French documentary film called Terrorists in Retirement, which was about a resistance network that was made up of immigrant communist workers in Paris during the occupation. And the leader of the resistance network was an Armenian named Misak Manouchian. And I had never heard of this sort of chapter in resistance history or Armenian history before, and I was completely fascinated. As I started reading more, there's a fair amount been written about Misak Manouchian and his resistance network. I started thinking, what would it have been like for these Armenian genocide survivors who had, you know, made their way to France, most of them through Marseille and then some of them up into Paris, and rebuilt their lives. And there they are in 1940, having rebuilt their lives in their communities. And they look out, you know, in this particular community I chose in Belleville, the neighborhood of Belleville, they look out the window and the Nazis, you know, the German troops are literally marching down the Rue de Belleville. And I didn't want to write about Manouchian and, you know, have it be a sort of resistance novel per se. I really wanted to do it from the point of view of a young woman and her experience. I mean, in the first chapter, the end of the first chapter of the book, I say, this is the story of how we lived the war and how I found my husband. And so it was, I wanted to tell those two stories, the war and then her sort of her own growth and awakening and finding this husband, which for me, it was also, I had studied as an undergraduate the Bildungsroman, or the novel of formation, which is the story of sort of coming-of-age tales about the conflict between a, you know, young man and his society and how he finds his place in it. And at the time, all the books I read were all by men, and I ended up taking a, you know, women's studies class where we looked at novel of formation for women, and it said, you know, for women, this kind of book ends either with marriage or death. And I thought marriage was a good option.
Much better option, exactly. So you really did a tremendous amount of research for this book, and it was like 10 years in the making. And you, you also lived in this Parisian neighborhood where the story takes place, right?
I lived not exactly in that neighborhood. The Belleville is sort of a part of Paris where the 11th, the 12th, the 19th, and the 20th arrondissements all meet. And when I was a student in Paris, I lived in the 11th arrondissement, not quite in Belleville, but not very far from there. But when I was doing the research for the book, I went back and, you know, spent afternoons just walking around the neighborhood, looking at the parks, looking at this, you know, the cemetery, all the sort of locales that are featured in the book.
Not a bad place to place your story, right? Get to wander around and you got to get those details right about the, you know, the parks, right? Now, so tell us a little bit about your research and how you found Armenians still living in Paris to interview.
I know journalists always have people that they call fixers, you know, when you you're sent to do a story someplace and you need to find someone, you know, who lives there, who knows the scene. So I had a friend of a friend who lives in Paris and has lived there since the late 70s. And he's Armenian. He was born in Beirut. And I told him, this is the story I want to tell. I want to do this family, working class family in Belleville, Armenians. And I want to talk to people who lived through the war years. So he found all these different people for me to interview, really fascinating people. One of the last surviving members of the Manouchian group, whose name was Arsène Chakarian, interviewed him. I met another man who was in the Armenian Hunchak, which is the Armenian Communist Party resistance. I met a woman who was 7 years old, living in Belleville in 1940. Her father was a shoemaker, and she actually saw the German troops coming down the Rue de Belleville when, you know, she was 7 years old. And then several years later, her family ended up harboring for a while one of her Jewish schoolmates when the family, the parents were deported.
Yeah. So your characters in the book, are they sort of a composite of all of these people you interviewed then?
I think the more than a composite, the way that I think of it is almost as though, you know, the way a bird builds a nest, as you sort of, a bird flies around and pulls a twig and a ribbon and a, you know, lint and like grasses and builds a nest with it. And I feel like that I go around collecting all these like tiny narratives and stories from people. Mm-hmm. And then I use them as I'm creating the characters and creating the narrative.
Yeah. Now, as you said, the story is told through the eyes of this teenage girl, Meryl. She's living with her family in Paris. And like many Armenians who fled the genocide, they're trying to build a new life, as you mentioned. So the Germans seize Paris, and the response of the Armenian adults is to hunker down, embrace themselves for the fear and deprivation that they know so well. But the children, Meryl, her brother, Misak, and their close friend, Zavin, find ways to resist their oppressors. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And I'm sure it's based on, you know, the organized resistance movement during that time.
Yes. There's a line early on when Maral's brother, Misak, is getting involved in this sort of just neighborhood resistance of, you know, marking victory signs and so on the walls of Belleville. And she says to him, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? You know, you could get in trouble. And at one point he gets arrested. And he says, you know, the point is when you have a boot on your neck, you have to try to lift your head. Mm. And that was this, I had, you know, had this feeling of people trying to lift their heads, you know, even with this terrible sort of violence and oppression. And also the title of the book, All the Light There Was, the idea was, this was a very dark time. It was literally dark because they had blackouts at night, and it was metaphorically and emotionally dark because, you know, you couldn't trust your neighbor. There were people being arrested. Your neighbors were being deported. And the idea was that this was going to be a book about sort of a candle in dark times and the way that people remained humane in the face of this, you know, very inhumane occupation.
Right. There's a turning point in the story when Zavin, who's, as we mentioned, a family friend, but also a romantic interest of Meryl's, flees with his brother to avoid conscription. But only one of the brothers returns, and Meryl is forced to make some very difficult decisions. So what inspired you to use the voice of a young person to tell this story rather than one of the adults?
Someone just asked me that at a book event I did last night, and I don't know that I ever thought strategically, oh, this is why I'm doing it. I just knew I think I'm a feminist, and I'm really interested in women's voices and women's stories. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in this idea of doing a coming of age story.
Right.
So I think that was why I came up with the character of Meryl. And the first draft I did, which was not such a great draft, it was written in the third person, and it was really long, and it was bristling with every single fact that I had learned, you know, from, you know, what food they had and when they changed the ration tickets and when they changed the curfew. And it was sort of just bristling with research. And I wanted to sort of bring the reader in closer and make it feel more intimate. So I switched it to the first person. And then I really started hearing, you know, Maurel's voice telling the story.
Yeah. It's funny how, you know, whenever we talk to authors and, you know, you have this path you start on and you think you know where the story's going. And there's this one character that just kind of keeps jumping in front of you. You know, it's like they sometimes it's a character you think is going to play a minor role and all of a sudden they've got the starring role. And so that's what's happening to you. Maurel's talking to you. So you're saying, I need to be the one telling the story.
Right. That kind of was what happened. And there was another, there's a character in the book who's an Armenian who ends up, it was this very weird chapter in history that I had never really known about before until I started doing the research. And then I actually met someone in Paris who had lived this experience who told me his story, but that there were a number of Soviet Armenians who were captured by the Germans and put in POW camps in Poland where they were being basically starved to death. And at a certain point, some of them, these Armenians were offered the opportunity to join the German army, which would mean not starving to death in the camp. And they did. And they were sent to France to work along the fortification the Germans were building along the Atlantic coast. And so I ended up telling this story. And when those Armenians were on leave from being in the German army, they would come to Paris. And the members of the local Armenian community would welcome them. Partly, there was a line in there where one of the characters says to this Armenian in the German uniform, I know under that uniform there beats an Armenian heart. Mm. So there was this, you know, kind of still solidarity under that. Mm. And they weren't, it was like literally a choice between life or death for some of these guys. Mm-hmm. And so I met someone in Paris who had lived this experience and told me the story. And it was so fascinating, all the details of how he was captured, how he was in the POW camp, how he was, you know, then tried to escape from the German army and was put in another POW camp, and just sort of this amazing trajectory. And I thought, oh, I have to use this in the book.
Yeah, and in fact, there was a French entertainer who, his family was one of the families that would help some of these guys.
Right. Yeah. That was Charles Aznavour, he's a very famous French singer, and he's of Armenian descent. And his family did actually invite these Armenian guys over when they were in Paris on leave from, you know, the army, and try to convince them to leave, then go underground and join the resistance. And the ones that actually agreed and that said yes, Charles Aznavour, who was maybe 17, 18 at the time, his job was to take their boots and their uniforms and after curfew to go out and drop them in the sewers of Paris.
Right. Now, Maurel's parents and her aunt all survived the Armenian genocide. And despite their fears for their own health and safety during the occupation, they helped save a Jewish child who might otherwise have perished in a concentration camp. And they do this in secrecy because they're not sure if their neighbors are pro-Nazi. And this is based on stories that were real, right? I mean, you heard real stories like this. Yeah.
Yes, I did. I heard the one story from the woman I mentioned earlier, who was 7 years old at the time, who had sheltered one of her schoolmates. And I read voluminously, like my bibliography, you know, for this book was probably, I don't know, at least 200 books that I read. Mm-hmm. And I read a lot of narratives. I mean, one of the little details is, you know, so they take in this Jewish child who lives across the hall. The parents are being deported and end up in one of the death camps. They take the child in, and then they have to try to smuggle her, you know, to what was at the time the free zone. And the way that this was even possible was because the brother, Misak, is in the resistance, so he has contacts. Mm. And then because the kid is very young, you didn't have to wear the yellow star or have an identity card until you are, I can't remember if it was 5 or 6, but the kid is young enough that she doesn't have that, so it makes it possible them to smuggle her, you know, through the demarcation line into the free zone.
Yeah. Your book also portrays Meryl's struggle with what she sees as either a proposition to be a wife and a mother, as the time period expects, or to pursue her education and her career. We also see Meryl begin to adopt more of the French culture, even as her family retains their Armenian roots, a struggle that clearly many in that community would face.
Right. And it's kind of funny because someone said to me, well, as a feminist, you know, how could you have her? She, you know, she is in the university and then she drops out. Like, how is that? And I was just really trying to think about who this character was and what decisions she would have made in the face of all the things that the war brought them and the choices. You know, then she had to make different choices about what she was going to do with her life and how she was going to live. And she ends up getting married and she ends up getting pregnant. It doesn't make any sense for someone in whatever that is, 1946, to stay, you know, at the Sorbonne, you know, taking literature classes when her family, everybody's still sort of struggling to survive. And she's now going to have this baby.
Yeah. So now we talked about the research. You spent, you know, 10 years and an awful lot of time researching and writing this book. So and I'm sure that's the same for your previous books. So do you take time off now in between before you start a big project? And when you're, you know, 10 years into research, you've got to really be interested in this topic. You know, you've really got to have, you know, really feel a passion for it.
I remember one time when I was a student in Paris, we went on a tour of the Gobelin tapestry works, which is, you know, where they make those enormous, they've been making them for centuries, these enormous tapestries that are made on these huge looms, you know, like the one, you know, much taller than the person who's working on them. And they told us, oh, you know, one tapestry would take a person working full time 5 years. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, you must really have to love those colors and that pattern to be doing that. And I do actually love. I love doing the research. I really enjoy writing, but even more than that, I enjoy doing the research. The thing that was very funny with this is the experience was so immersive of the research and the writing that at a certain point, one of the two things that came across very strongly about how people lived through these war years and this occupation was that everybody was really cold in the winter. Everybody was really hungry all the time because the only people who had enough food were the Germans, the collaborators, and the extremely wealthy people who could buy on the black market. Other than that, everybody else was hungry and sort of living on turnips. And so I would go every day for, you know, the 5 years, 6 years that I was writing the book to this place. I was like in Paris and it was cold and it was dark and everybody was hungry. And at one point my husband opened up our pantry and he said to me, why do we have 15 jars of French mustard? And it turned out I had started really, it was so crazy. I started unconsciously stockpiling all these things like mustard and jam and and scented soap and, you know, olive oil and all these things that my characters didn't have.
Yeah, you were really immersed into your story for sure.
I was so in it. But I've started working on the next one, which is about, which the idea came to me while I was researching this one because my friend Hagop, who was my fixer in Paris, was from Beirut. And when I was there, I would end up going out to dinner with him and his friends who are all from Beirut, and they would start telling stories about the Civil War and what the Armenian community was like before the Civil War. And so I thought, oh, wow, look at this again. These Armenians from the genocide, they go to Beirut, rebuild their lives. Their children then build this amazing, you know, there's a cultural flowering and there's theater and there's literary magazines and folk singing groups and all this. And then the Civil War comes and shoots it all to hell.
So that's your next one.
My new project.
Okay.
Right. It's number 4 in the Armenian Diaspora Quartet.
There you go. Nancy Krikorian, thanks so much for being with us. Her new book is All the Light There Was. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Alan Mattis and Margaret Carsley for production assistance in Boston, which is where Nancy joined us from. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.